The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 18 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Cuzco of Today. Modern Cuzco is not one-tenth the size of the city that Pizarro plundered. It has now only about 20,000 inhabitants, including Indians and whites and the half-breed offspring of the two races. It is more like a city of old Spain built during the days of Columbus than the magnificent capital it was when the Incas ruled here. The Spaniards made of Cuzco a town of 1, 2, and 3-story structures built of stone or plastered adobe. Its roofs of light red tiles sparkle under the blue sky and the bright sun of the Andes. The houses have gay colored walls. They are close to the sidewalks, lining the narrow, cobble-paved streets. High above the houses rise the domes and the spires of the great churches and convents built by the Spaniards when they had grown rich by enslaving the Indians and taking the vast hoards of silver and gold they found in the city. Cuzco has a church for every 1,000 inhabitants, and some of them are so magnificent that they would attract attention in any city of Europe. In the center of town is a beautiful plaza, the site of what was once the chief square of the Inca capital. During Spanish rule, it was the scene of many acts of cruelty and torture. It was here in 1571 that the boy Inca, Tupac Amaru, was beheaded after being taken prisoner by the Spaniards. Following his capture, he was instructed in the Christian faith by two priests and later baptized. On the day of his execution, he was dressed in white robes and led to this plaza where hundreds of his subjects had gathered. However, when the executioner brought out his knife and prepared to strike, such a wail of horror and protestation arose from both Indians and Spaniards that the beheading was stopped. Messengers were sent to the Viceroy of Peru at his Cuzco headquarters asking for mercy, but their intercession was of no avail and the execution was carried out. Afterward, the viceroy caused the head of Tupac to be set up on a pole in the plaza, but when he learned that the Inca's subjects came there each night and knelt in silent adoration and worship, he ordered it to be buried with the body. The plaza does not now cover more than 4 or 5 acres, but 5 churches face upon it, including the Cathedral of Cuzco, which alone covers several acres. Across the way is the great structure of La Compañía, which was built by the Jesuits as their chief house of worship. Adjoining is the magnificent old Jesuit convent, where the monks worked and taught. When the government drove the Jesuits out, the building was turned into a university. The patio about which the Holy Fathers strolled is now used as a tennis court, and as I passed by, I saw the students driving the balls back and forth over the net. Another great church is La Merced, through which I was guided by a young priest. Its interior is a mass of carving, including fluted stone columns and a ceiling paneled in cedar. The Church of Santo Domingo stands on the foundation of the old Temple of the Sun, as I have already pointed out, and that of San Francisco has a choir famous for its rich carving. The little chapel of San Blas has the finest wood pulpit in the world. It was carved by the descendants of the Incas and is considered so unusual that $25,000 was recently offered for it. The Cathedral of Cuzco is one of the finest of all the Catholic churches in South America. It is particularly noted for the beautiful tone of its bell, said to be due to the large amount of gold it contains. 300 pounds of the precious metal was given by one woman, by whose name, Maria Angola, the bell is now known. The cathedral is a vast museum of carvings plated with gold, of wonderful paintings, some of them by old masters, and of chapels with altars of solid silver and woodwork inlaid with gold. Some of the paintings are 40 feet high and 20 feet wide, and there is one of the Last Supper that measures about 30 by 40 feet. A few are by Murillo, one is by Van Dyck, and several are the work of Domenichino. One of the altars was presented by Charles V of Spain, and some of the paintings were given by Philip II. In one of the walls of the sacristy is a vault filled with treasures, including gold, silver, and precious stones, valued at more than $1 million. In this vault is the custodia, a box that contains the sacrament used at the time of processions. This box weighs 36 pounds, and it was made of the solid gold plates taken from the Temple of the Sun. The diamonds and emeralds on it are worth even more than the gold itself. These treasures are stored away in a closet with a door of wrought iron, so rude that it could be opened by any safe breaker or ordinary burglar. It is perhaps the reverence of the people and their fear of damnation that preserve the contents of the vault from theft. One of the treasures in the cathedral is a life-size statue of Christ, fastened to a wooden cross by great nails of gold. The figure is decorated with jewels, and the pedestal, or car, upon which the cross stands, is plated with silver and encrusted with diamonds. This image is greatly revered in Cusco. It is carried through the streets on Good Monday, at which time the people kneel down on the sidewalks before it and pray. They call it the Lord of the Earthquakes, and think that their city is safe from seismic disturbances as long as the annual procession takes place. This belief comes from a tradition that once, when the statue was left in the church, beyond the hour usually set for the procession, the mountains began to sway and an earthquake occurred. Thereupon the image was brought out, and the earth ceased its quaking. As I stood in the cathedral, Mass was being celebrated. 200 women, dressed all in black, with black shawls over their heads, knelt on the stone floor. Sprinkled among them were patches of color made by the Indian men, who wore ponchos of red, blue, or yellow, and whose bare feet were turned up to the roof as they muttered their prayers. There were also Indian women in short skirts and red shawls, each with a pack or a baby on her back. There is no doubt about the religious nature of these people of the high Andes. The Quichuas, who are the descendants of the subjects of the Incas, are the chief churchgoers of Peru. It is they who furnish the chief support of the priesthood, and although in direst poverty, they give much of what they earn for the maintenance of the church. In traveling through the country, I saw a little wooden cross rising above the thatched roof of every Indian hut, and the services at the cathedral here are attended by more Indians than whites. Along with their worship of Christ and the Virgin Mary, they still retain many of the ancient ceremonies and beliefs of the Incas. They pray facing the sun, and they cross themselves and offer a prayer when they approach or leave Cusco, the sacred city of their ancestors. Crossing the plaza from the cathedral, I visited the portales, or stores, where Indian goods are sold. They occupy the ground floors of a block of two-story houses, the upper stories of which extend out over the street and are upheld by stone columns, forming an arcade. These stores are like caves in the wall, and their doorways look as though they were cut out with a cross-cut saw. I arrived in Cusco on a saint's day, when the shops were hidden behind thick slabs of wood that come together like the folding doors of a barn, and are fastened with great wrought iron padlocks centuries old. Single locks weigh 10 or 20 pounds, and they are so constructed that one must use a half dozen keys to open them. All the storekeepers are women. They are fat cholas who wear very full skirts and keep their shawls and hats on while attending to business. Many of them do some manufacturing in addition to their selling. Kneeling or sitting on the floor, they make various garments with little hand sewing machines that they rest on boxes or chairs. From these shops, I walked around the corner and up a narrow street walled with stores that are larger but have the same cave-like entrances. One block is called Coca Street because every shop on each side of it has bales of coca leaves among its wares. These leaves, which are the source of our cocaine, are chewed for their narcotic effect. I noticed that all of the Indians bought coca and that most of them had quids of these leaves in their cheeks at the time. Going on, I passed an ancient fountain where Indian house servants were filling their water jars. This fountain represents a young girl with what looks like a chrysanthemum over her head, on the top of which is a cross. The figure is nude, and out of the breasts pour two continuous streams of water. A little farther on, I stop to look at the market. Half of the plaza where it is located is covered with long galvanized iron sheds. Under the sheds are zinc counters upon which meat is spread out for sale, and farther on are sheds for vegetables, where the Indian women sit on the stones with their wares piled around them. Still farther on are sheds for fruits, and in the open spaces out in the sun, llama droppings and charcoal are being sold as fuel. There are other peddlers here and there, and scattered about are cookshops, where the Quechua Indians are eating soup and fried stuffs cooked on clay stoves or sheet iron plates. I ask as to the prices of various goods I saw, and learn that meat costs the same whether it comes from a lamb or an old ram, and without regard to the cut. Having no scales, the butcher women guess at the weight. Neither are vegetables sold by measure, but in piles. The usual price per pile is 2.5 cents in our money, the size varying in accordance with the article. Here is a woman selling red peppers, for example. She has before her a cloth covered with piles containing 10 each. In the next stall are handfuls of green beans, and beside them cakes of native cheese the size of a biscuit, which can be bought for a nickel. A little farther on, a woman is selling quinoa and kernels of corn half as long as one's finger. The corn is of many colors and varieties. Some is as black as my boots, some bright yellow, and the next pile is dark red. Hominy grains as big as the end of my thumb are sold wrapped in a cloth that looks like a dirty dish rag. I am interested in the potatoes. Peru is their natural home, and the great-great-great-grandfathers of all our potatoes were born on this high plateau of the Andes. The tubers are of all sizes. Some are as big as my fist, others no bigger than a thimble. They are equally varied in color, black, red, and yellow. I see also much chuño being sold. Chuño looks like bits of bleached bone, but is really potatoes that have been frozen and dried so that they can be kept for years without spoiling. It is prepared from a special variety of potatoes about the size of a baseball. They are first soaked in water overnight. Early in the morning, before the sun rises, they are taken out and allowed to freeze. They are then covered with straw to keep off the sun. The next night, they are soaked and frozen again. This process is continued from night to night until the potatoes become soft, when the Indians tread off the skins with their bare feet. The potatoes are now as white as snow, and after being dried will keep a long time. They have to be soaked before cooking, and are usually served in a soup or a stew. Sometimes they are sliced and eaten as sandwiches with cheese between the slices. I have eaten chuño made into stew, but found it insipid. Perhaps it might have been more appetizing to me had I not seen so frequently how it was prepared. It is interesting to watch the market women. The cholas wear straw hats and shawls and skirts that reach almost to the ankles. They have lighter complexions than the full-blooded Indians. The latter women have hats like pie pans with upturned brims and low crowns. They wear also shawls of red, blue, yellow, or black, and embroidered waists and voluminous skirts that stand out like those our girls wore in the days of wire petticoats. They carry bundles on their backs and often babies on the tops of the bundles. There are hundreds of Indian men walking through the market, buying and selling. They have flat, round hats with upturned brims, underneath which are bright-colored knit caps with ear flaps that hang down to their necks. Some of the Indians are driving llamas loaded with goods, and some carry on their shoulders great packs containing vegetables and other products that they have brought in from far away in the country. The whole scene is one of bright colors, but it is not noisy, and the people are apathetic and dull. They talk in low tones, and they seem very timid. When I point my camera at them, the women hide their faces, and the children howl and go off on the run. One of the odd sights of the market, and also of the streets throughout Cusco, is the traffic and the way freight is carried. Nearly everything comes in from the country on donkeys, mules, or llamas, or on the backs of men and women. There are not more than a half dozen automobiles in the city, and most people go about on foot or on horse or muleback. When I arrived in Cuzco on a former visit to Peru, the station master had been instructed by the superintendent of the railroad to see that I got to my hotel, and as I had a great deal of baggage, I asked him to hire a carriage. He replied that there were no carriages in Cuzco, but that we could take the streetcar, while my typewriter and trunks could be carried on the backs of Indian cargadores. I found the streetcar to be a long box resting on wheels, with a team of four shaggy mules as the motive power. There were a half dozen such cars, each with its separate team, and they were so crowded that I was barely able to get standing room. The cars ran only to the trains, which arrived and departed three times a week, so that if one could get a ride a day, he was lucky. It was about a mile and a half from the railroad depot to the main plaza, and our mules went on the gallop. My hotel is run on the European plan, and I am able to get two good rooms at a reasonable rate. We take our meals at a hotel that faces the great plaza and the cathedral. The entrance to this house is a cave-like passageway through evil-smelling and dirty courts, and it is only when I reach the dining room that I dare to cease holding my nose. Once there, the accommodations are fair. The food is Peruvian, but the eggs are fresh and the meats are good. The landlord tries to please, and his price for three meals is low. Altogether, I am delighted with Cuzco. The sky is blue, the sun is bright, and the surroundings full of interest. On one hand are the quaintness of the present city and the strange costumes of the Indians, and on the other are the ruins of the Incas and the romance of a civilization that has passed away. End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Stories of Buried Treasure. I have heard stories of buried treasure all along the Andes, from Panama to southern Peru. The Incas had vast stores of gold and silver that for four centuries white men have been attempting to recover. Only a few weeks ago, I met a party of Americans and British in Cerro de Pasco who were prospecting for one of these hoards. They had already spent thousands of dollars and were spending more every day. I heard other stories at Urcos, a little mud town on the railroad just south of Cuzco. It is high up in the Andes, more than 2 miles above the sea, and not far from Lake Urcos, in which Inca treasures are said to be buried. When the Spaniards under Pizarro had killed the Inca king, Atahualpa, they marched upon Cuzco. The Indians knew the Spaniards' greed for precious metals, and they took most of their treasures from the capital city and buried them. According to tradition, they threw millions of dollars worth of gold into this lake, among other things the great golden chain that surrounded their main plaza. This plaza was about 500 feet long and several hundred feet wide, so that the length of the chain was probably nearly 2,000 feet. It was made of pure gold, wrought into links about a foot long and as large around as my wrist. The links were so heavy that a man could not lift more than one of them at a time, and hundreds of Indians were required to carry the chain to the lake. It is supposed to lie there to this day, although many have searched for it in vain. The treasure hunters have dived into the waters and have raked over the mud near the shore. They have also used grappling hooks to drag the bottom, which in places lies hundreds of feet below the surface. At one time, a syndicate, capitalized at $5 million, was organized to tunnel the mountainside and drain the lake in order to get at the gold. The difficulties encountered were so many, however, that the enterprise was abandoned. All the ornaments and the utensils used in the religious ceremonies of the Incas were made of gold or silver. In the Temple of the Sun were golden ewers that held the water used at the time of sacrifices, and there were 12 silver jars kept filled with Indian corn. There was a golden llama with golden fleece, and also golden birds and golden flowers, all of life size. The Spaniards found a vast amount of gold in the cemeteries of the Incas. the precious metal having been buried with many of the monarchs. There is a record of one Garcia Gutierrez paying to the Spanish crown 1/5 of the treasures he found in the graveyards at Trujillo, which netted him more than 677,000 castellanos of gold. Gold and silver plates have been found fastened to the heads of mummies and skeletons dug up in the excavations at Tiahuanaco in Bolivia. The building of the great cathedral in Cuzco is said to have been brought about by the discovery of Inca treasure. According to the legend, it began with a miraculous dream of the bishop, in which the Virgin Mary appeared before him and told him that she wanted a cathedral in Cuzco. She fixed the location of the ancient plaza of the Incas and described the building as it now is. The bishop replied that his people were poor and that he could not possibly raise the sum needed. Thereupon the Madonna directed him to go to a place near Cuzco and dig. This was duly reported to the people, who, as the story goes, went with the bishop in a great procession to the spot designated. They dug down into the earth and there found a large store of gold. It was with this gold that they began to build the cathedral, which is, as I have said, one of the finest churches in the New World. A second story of lost treasure relates to a Cuzco man of Spanish descent whom the Lord blessed with numerous children. It is the custom here that a godfather shall look after and provide for his godchild. And so, as this man was poor, he tried to add to his resources by having a corps of good godfathers. As the infants were born, he named each in honor of one of the distinguished citizens of the town. The citizens, however, did not respond, and the man grew poorer and poorer. At last he had 9 children, each of whom had a rich godfather, but there was no help forthcoming. The father then vowed that he would choose as the patron of his next child the first man he met on the street after its birth. In due time the stork came again, and the father, rushing out of the house, saw a poor Indian driving a caravan of llamas into the town. He stopped him and asked him to be godfather to the child. The Indian objected, saying that he was poor and not fit to be godfather to a white child. The man then told him of his vow and finally persuaded the Indian to accept the honor. When the baby was baptized, the Indian appeared at the ceremony as its godfather, and the next day came back into Cuzco with a score of llamas loaded with wood. He took the wood to the father of his godchild, saying that he had brought what he could as a gift. He was thanked, and the wood was stored away in the court of the house. Sometime after that, the bundles of sticks and roots were opened, and inside each was found a bag of gold in nuggets and dust. In the meantime, the Indian had disappeared and could not be found. The Spaniard took the gold and built 2 large houses on the street called Triumph, which the people of Cuzco will show you today. Another treasure story is the tale of an Indian woman 100 years old. It relates to a great hoard of gold that was hidden in the Andes by an Indian chief who was murdered on his way back to Cuzco. It had long been searched for in vain by both foreigners and Peruvians. Not long ago, this old Indian woman, being about to die, sent word to a bahindado of Spanish descent for whom she had worked, asking him to hasten to her. He reached her hut in the mountains just in time to get her last message. This was that her maternal grandmother, who had died 80 years before, had given her a word that would indicate where the treasure lay. The word was an Indian one meaning the Lake of the 2 Stones. The old woman was questioned, but she would tell nothing more, and that night she died. The whole country was searched by treasure hunters, all seeking the Lake of the 2 Stones. At last, a narrow valley was discovered, containing a lake in which there were 2 tall rocks rising out of the water. The lake was drained, and the treasure was found in a chamber under the largest stone. The discovery was kept a secret from the officials for fear of confiscation, and so no one knows how much gold was discovered. It is said to have been of such great value that it made wealthy all those who participated in finding it. Still another Indian legend tells the story of a treasure cave in a mountain near Cuenca in Ecuador. This cave contains a mighty store of gold, but its entrance is closed by a giant of granite under whose arm is a hole that is open only on Good Friday. Then, and then only, the giant raises his arm, and whoever is there at that time can crawl in under it. As the story goes, the gold is in piles, and only one pile is to be taken at a time. If a man takes only the assigned quantity, he will get away safely. But if he is greedy and takes more, he will be squeezed to death by the arm of the giant as he goes out. The Indians have great faith in this story, and many superstitious people have looked for the cave, hoping to reach it in time for Good Friday. A fairly well authenticated tradition refers to an Inca named Ruminagui, who is said to have carried away the gold and silver of Quito and buried it. This treasure was taken from the palaces of Atahualpa and from the temples and the convents of the Virgins of the Sun. It is said that some of the gold was intended to be sent to Cajamarca for Atahualpa's ransom, but that Ruminagui, anticipating the treachery of the Spaniards, buried the treasure on the way. News of what he had done came to the Spaniards, and Sebastian de Benalcazar, one of the subordinate officers under Pizarro, took 150 men and started for Quito. He searched along the route, followed by Ruminagui, but found nothing. In the meantime, Ruminagui had dug traps in the trails and made snares to destroy the enemy and their horses in case he was followed. Also, in order to save them from the Spaniards, he had set fire to Quito and killed the Virgins of the Sun before Benalcazar appeared. He then climbed to a high mountain behind the city, where he was finally captured by Benalcazar. He was tortured to make him tell where the golden hoard was secreted, but refused to talk, even though finally put to death. An Indian boy named Catuna, the son of one of the Inca chiefs, who was with his father at the time this hoard was secreted, was injured in one of the battles and left as dead. Captain Suarez, a Spaniard, later discovered that Catuna was still alive and took the boy home with him. Catuna's injuries were so severe that his features were distorted and he became a hunchback. Captain Suarez taught him to read and write and converted him to Christianity. Later, Suarez became unfortunate in his speculations, and his house was about to be sold to satisfy his creditors. Then Catuna said that he would produce enough gold to pay off the debts if he were given some equipment for smelting. He also made Suarez promise to say nothing as to the source of any sudden wealth. This was agreed to, and Catuna, working in a secret vault under the house, supplied so much treasure that Suarez became a rich man. He gave large sums to the church, and when he died in 1550, he made Catuna his heir. When questioned as to where the money came from, Catuna said that he had made a compact with the evil one, to whom he had sold his soul for this gold. This statement was credited because at that time the Indians were believed to have regular intercourse with the devil. After Catuna's death, his home was searched and the vault discovered. It contained a large quantity of gold in ingots and bars, and also in vessels of gold that evidently came from the Incas. The people, however, persisted in believing that the story of the pact with the devil was true. And, says Father Velasco, from whose letters this story comes, the truth would have never been discovered if it had not been that Catuna's confessor, a Franciscan monk, had left a written account of the burial of Atahualpa's treasure, which had been told to him. I heard a story in Cuzco of an Indian girl who was in love with a Spaniard, and who told him that she would make him the richest man in Peru if he would marry her. He promised that he would if she would prove that she could do what she proposed. At her request, he went with her one night into the mountains, where he was blindfolded and led through ravine after ravine. They finally reached a cave where the bandages were removed from his eyes, and his sweetheart said, "Behold, there is the gold that I am ready to give you when we are married." The Spaniard looked down and saw a great deal of golden bars and a collection of golden vessels curiously carved, probably from the treasures of Atahualpa. He attempted to seize some of the largest pieces near him, but the girl pulled him back, saying, "Those things are sacred until we are wedded, and if you attempt to touch any of them or take away any, my friends who are here at hand will certainly kill you." The Spaniard, becoming frightened, threw down the gold and submitted again to being blindfolded. Upon his return to Cusco, he told the story to the authorities, and an order was issued for the arrest of the girl. The police hastened to her hut, but were too late. The girl and her family, hearing of the proposed arrest, had fled to the mountains, and that was the last ever known of the treasure. There are records left by the Spaniards describing several localities where they thought some of the Inca treasures might be found. One such record is in the writings of Valverde, who died in Spain. He was known to have gone many times into the mountains of Ecuador and to have brought out a great quantity of gold, the form of which showed it to have been a part of the treasures of Atahualpa. Valverde left directions giving the route to where the gold lay, and the King of Spain sent this description to Ambato, a town now on the railroad between the coast and Quito, ordering the officers there to search for the treasure. The manuscript of the king's letter, which I understand is still preserved, tells the searcher to stand on the mountain of Guapa, with his back to Ambato, and look to the east. From there can be seen three mountains in the form of a triangle surrounding an artificial lake, into which the ancients, when they heard of the death of the Inca king, threw the gold they had prepared for his ransom. The Spanish directions then tell one just how to get there and the dangers he is liable to incur on the way. He is supposed to reach a bog in which is gold that can be washed out in a stream nearby, and still farther on is said to be a cave in which is a furnace where the Indians melted their ores. Many have searched for this treasure, but it has never been found. A treasure hoard that really existed was found on the farm of a Spaniard who had built a wide and apparently unnecessary adobe wall between two of his fields. Before he died, he left strict injunctions that the land on which this wall was built was never to go out of the possession of his family. Years passed, and the great-great-grandson, who had inherited this piece of land, finally offered it for sale in order to raise money to meet his debts. The descendant of another branch of the family, remembering the story of his ancestors' last instructions, bought the property and immediately put all his peons at work demolishing the wall, long an eyesore to the neighborhood. Under it were found bars of gold and silver amounting to many times the value of the property. The finding of treasure in old buildings led many people to tear down their houses and devote much time and expense to searching for secret chambers and passages that might conceal untold wealth. One man, who actually discovered such a passage, found that it ended in a brick wall, which he assumed to be the outside of a treasure vault that had been closed up years before. Working in great secrecy, he pried the bricks out one by one, and at last saw a room filled with silver vases, candlesticks, beautiful china, and linens exquisitely embroidered. In his great excitement, he failed entirely to notice that everything was spick and span and in the finest condition, and it was only when a woman entered through a hitherto unnoticed door that he discovered that he had merely chiseled his way through the wall of his neighbor's house into his pantry. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Slaves of Alcohol and Cocaine. At the time of the Spanish conquest, it is estimated that there were between 20 and 40 millions of semi-civilized Indians on the high plateaus of the Andes. These were the Chibchas in Colombia, the Caras and Chancas in Ecuador, the Quichuas in Peru, the Aymaras in Bolivia, and further south in Chile, the brave Araucanians. The Chibchas were skilled in weaving and making pottery. They had learned to pave their highways and had developed their farming to a high degree of productivity. They had weights and measures and a currency of gold discs. The Caras had attained an advanced civilization with a military and a tribal organization, and the Araucanians met in grand councils to make laws and settle matters of public interest. The Aymaras, the chief race of Bolivia, ranked in progress with the Quichuas. Today, the majority of the Quichuas are as miserable and degraded as any human beings on earth. Not one in a hundred can read or write. They are mere hewers of wood and drawers of water, slaves to the coca leaf and alcohol. They are a race from which active mentality seems to have departed, and have shrunk in numbers from 8 millions in 1575 to a bare 1.5 million. I saw the Quichuas first in the high valleys of Ecuador, and found them everywhere as I went through Peru. I have seen them toiling along the trails with enormous loads on their backs, or driving their laden llamas and donkeys to the markets of the cities. In the towns, I have watched them sitting on the stone pavements of the plazas, with little stores of vegetables spread out before them, or carrying barrels of water and other burdens from house to house as the servants of the Cholas and the whites. In my trips to South America, I have not had time to make an exhaustive study of the Quichuas, but I have obtained much information about them from men who have lived in these countries for years. I have talked with plantation owners and mining operators, with teachers and missionaries, and in fact, with scores who employ Indians or are otherwise interested in them. An extreme view of their condition was given me by an American mining official who is a man of keen observation. He said, "Most of the Quichuas of the plateau appear to lack ordinary intelligence. If you tell one to fetch you a broom, he will bring you a shovel. If you send him for a hatchet, he will as likely as not return with a glass of water. If you knock him down and make him go back, the shock starts his brain working, and he may then get what you ask for." Another American, who has been here for many years, tells me that the Indian boys are intelligent until they reach the age of 15. They acquire the coca habit almost at birth, but they do not take to alcohol until they begin to work independently of their parents and can afford to buy liquor for themselves. From then on, they deteriorate, and they are on the downgrade for the rest of their lives. I believe that the cause of the mental degradation of the Quichua is due somewhat to oppression by the whites, but more to the use of alcohol and coca. Coca has been chewed by the Andean Indians since the days of the Incas, when any feat of strength or endurance was attributed to its use. In athletic contests, the victor's reward was a coca pouch woven in brilliant colors, the handiwork of an Indian maiden. Accompanying it was a small gourd containing lime or ashes to enhance the flavor of the coca. It was always a part of the equipment of the soldier on the march, and distances between different parts of the Inca Empire were often reckoned as so many handfuls of coca, meaning the amount of leaves necessary to sustain a man in making the trip. According to one writer of that period, 3 leaves supply for 6 days' march a ford. The Quitoita, with this provision stored, can pass the vast and cloudy Andes o'er. Coca was used also as an offering to the sun and to make smoke at sacrifices. One of the Inca ceremonies was to throw it into a river and allow it to float downstream, while parties of Indians kept pace with it on the banks for days. So that a man could have it to chew in the next world, pouches of it were usually buried with the dead. Every farmer gives his Indian laborers a handful of coca leaves each morning, and every mine owner has to supply a certain amount in addition to the regular wages paid. The full effect of the cocaine is obtained by rubbing the leaves between the palms to remove the tiny branches, chewing them into a ball, and then adding a small amount of lime, which is sold in the markets in the form of little cakes. The Indian not only chews coca, but he often brews from it a tea that he says he takes for his stomach's sake, but really for its effect as a stimulant. Coca drives away hunger and makes one feel the cold less. It enables one to breathe with greater ease in the higher altitudes of the Andes, and it is claimed that by using it, the Indians can work longer and endure more fatigue. I am told that chewing it also keeps the teeth white, and it is said that the Quichuas seldom suffer from toothache. Whatever its temporary effect may be, coca also numbs the brain, destroys the will, and dulls all forms of mental activity. Coca leaves come from a shrub that grows from 4 to 6 feet in height. They are picked green, dried, and put up in packages of 25 pounds each, which sell for about $2.50. I bought 10 cents worth at one of the stores of Cusco. The woman who waited upon me brought out a pair of old brass scales, balanced on the end of a beam, and weighed out a full pound. I took it home and chewed some, but it had no perceptible effect, probably because I had not the lime to go with it. I then made some into a tea, which made me feel very refreshed. As to alcohol, the extent to which it is used among the Indians is beyond conception. Drunken men and women by the score may be seen at any celebration, and in every part of the country, Indians with red faces and bleared eyes go reeling along the roads. The women drink quite as much as the men, and on holidays, both sexes give themselves up to drunken carousals. During my stay in Cusco, I went into some of the alcohol stores and was astounded at the vast quantity sold. There was a wholesale and retail liquor establishment just opposite my hotel. The storeroom facing the street was walled with tanks, each twice as high as a man and as large around as a boiler. I counted 12 such tanks standing upon platforms against the wall of that room. Each was marked as containing 2,000 liters of alcohol, and when I tapped upon them with my knife, I found they were full. That meant more than 24,000 quarts. Every tank had its faucet, and the liquor was drawn out by the gallon, the liter, or the bottle. The storekeeper seemed proud of his business and told me that he had made 1.5 million pounds of liquor every year. He sells it to the Indians for about $10 a quintal, or 100 pounds, and ships it to other towns throughout the province. He told me that the Hacienda Pachacha, where the brandy is made, consists of 4 great farms 90 miles from Cusco and requires from 800 to 1,000 Indian families to work it. Going into a court, I saw the goatskins containing 100 pounds each, in which the liquor is brought from the plantation. When I drank some, it burned my throat like liquid fire, and as I remarked upon its strength, the shopkeeper took a gauge and showed me that it was 53% pure alcohol. I saw other alcohol stores in Sicuani, and there are scores of them in Arequipa, in almost all the towns of the mountain districts. The Indian usually buys his liquor by the bottle, the number of which is limited only by the amount of money he has. In addition to alcohol, the Indians, men, women, and children, drink chicha, made from corn. It is for sale in the stores and may be obtained at wayside saloons everywhere in the mountains of Peru. The first step in the manufacture of chicha is to put the kernels of ripe corn into tanks in the earth. The corn is then sprinkled with water and covered with straw. It is kept wet until it swells and sprouts, after which it is taken out and boiled for a time. The liquid begins to ferment in a day or two and is soon ready to drink. I am told that the old-fashioned way of making chicha still prevails in some villages. By that method, the Indian girls shell off the ripe grains and grind them between their teeth, working their jaws until the saliva flows freely. When chewed sufficiently, the saliva-soaked meal is ejected into a wooden trough. The spittle starts fermentation, and after a short time, the mush, with some water added, has turned to a liquor with a high percentage of alcohol. It is said that this is the most intoxicating form of chicha known, and that its manufacture dates back to the days of the Incas. Cava, the intoxicating drink of the Samoas, is made in a similar way. As I see how the Indians live and work on these cold highlands of the Andes, I do not wonder that they are driven to coca and alcohol. Their homes are huts made of mud, so rude and squalid that in the United States they would hardly be considered fit for a cow stable or a hog pen. The typical dwelling is about 8 or 10 feet wide and perhaps 10 or 15 feet long, and it is so low that as an average-sized man stands outside it, his head reaches above where the sloping roof begins. It has walls of sod or mud, and its roof is of straw tied to poles. It has no windows, and the only door is a hole in the wall, so low that one has to stoop to go in. There is no furniture, although some of the huts have a mud ledge at the back upon which the family sleeps at night. Usually, however, grown-ups and children lie down on the ground on llama skins and huddle together to keep warm. They sleep in the same clothing they wear in the daytime, covering themselves with coarse blankets. Often the chickens and sometimes the hogs sleep in the hut with the family. The Americans, who employ large numbers of Indians at Cerro de Pasco and furnish quarters for them at a low rent, have to order the hogs cleared out of the huts every few weeks. Meals are cooked on a little clay stove in one corner of the house. The fuel is the droppings of llamas and cattle, peat, or the stunted vegetation of the pampas. There is no chimney, and the smoke blackens the roof of the hut and escapes through the door. The Indians exist on a limited diet, consisting of mutton or llama meat and potatoes, barley, chuño, or corn, which they soak and cook as a stew. Most of the farms and the haciendas on the Andean plateau are owned by the whites or the cholos. Some of the estates are so large that one may ride all day across them without reaching the boundaries. On all of them are large numbers of Indians who lease patches of ground on such terms as make them practically the slaves of the owners. I have had a long talk with the Basidamdo, who owns almost 300,000 acres of land near Cusipata in the province of Paucartambo. He spends only a part of the summer there and lives for the rest of the year in Cusco. He talked freely of conditions on his hacienda, looking upon the practical enslavement of the Indians as a matter of course. "Land here is cheap," he said. "The estate at Cusipata cost me only about 4 cents an acre when I bought it some years ago. Including the livestock, I paid only 20,000 soles, or about $10,000 for the property. The highest land, which runs up to 16,000 feet above the sea, is suitable only for pasture. I have big flocks of alpacas and llamas and about 8,000 sheep, as well as cattle and horses and donkeys. I have also some land as low as 10,000 feet upon which barley, potatoes, quinoa, and other crops can be grown. The most important asset on the property, however, is the Indians. It is valued not according to its area, but by the number of families of Indians who have homes upon it and are therefore obliged to work for me. If it were not for the Indians living on the estate, I could get no one to work my land. Therefore, I hold them by keeping them more or less in debt to me. I advance money for the purchase of cattle, llamas, and alpacas, and for feast days and marriages and funerals. The only way an Indian can get out of debt to me would be by finding some other proprietor to assume his obligation. In that case, he could move, but he would be only going from one master to another. Some of the Indians are in debt, only $30 or $40, and others owe as much as $300. I loan them money according to the value of their stock, being careful not to let them have more than the animals would bring at forced sale. One of my Indians owns 400 alpacas, and some own sheep and cattle to a value of $300 or $400 and even $1,000. Such men work on the same conditions as the others and do not live any differently. According to my contracts, every Indian man has to work for me 5 days of each week, which leaves only Saturday and Sunday for himself, with the exception of holidays and saints' days. He receives no wages except an ounce and a half of coca a day. That is about a handful, and it costs only 4 cents a week per man. It is also agreed that each of the three Indian villages on the farm shall furnish me a manservant, or pongo, and a woman servant to work in my house or for someone else if I direct. The pongos are changed from month to month, and a new one is always on hand before the old one leaves. The Indians also agree not to trade with a stranger without my permission, and to give me the first chance to buy anything they sell. As a rule, they will not do business with anyone else under any circumstances, not even if the prices offered were 10 times what I pay. In return for the use of pasture land, the Indians also give me 10% of the increase of their flocks and herds. At certain times of the year, all the sheep and the cattle must be branded and counted in order that I may collect my share of the stock. My estate is 54 miles from Cusco, and the Indians who own llamas must take the products to that town or to anywhere else I may direct. For the trip to Cusco, I pay them $2 for 2,750 pounds and furnish their food for the journey. It takes them about a week to go to Cusco and back, and they sleep at night on the road. I allow the Indians to keep as many llamas as they please, for every animal adds to the freight-carrying facilities of my property. But doesn't this method of carrying crops to markets so cheaply compete with the railroads, I ask? Of course it does, replied the Basadando. Why should I use the railroad to market my crops when I can have my Indians do it for practically nothing? I would not give a centavo to have a railroad go through my estate. If it did, my family and I would be the only ones to use it. If I send my goods to market on the backs of llamas, it takes a little longer, but if the wait is short, when they reach their destination, the Indian is responsible. Suppose I ship 100 pounds of barley to Cusco by rail, and it arrives 4 pounds short. I could not get damages from the railroad, but I could compel the Indian to make up the deficit. He is responsible for everything he carries, and if he should break a plate or a glass in the load of goods he brings me, he has to pay for it. But how can you force the Indians to submit to such treatment? They have been used to it for generations and have never known anything else. Besides, we can punish them in various ways. For small offenses, we can lock them up in a barn for a couple of days on a water diet. We can also whip them for stealing, provided we are careful not to let the authorities hear of what we are doing. Or we can make them come to Cusco to work as pongos. Sometimes the Indians are badly treated, and I know of an instance on my own farm where an Indian was hanged to the top of a eucalyptus tree by a rope tied under his arms and left there for 2 hours. If the overseer had been found out, he would have gone to jail for 2 or 3 years. Justice, however, is more in favor of the master than the servant in this part of the world, and although the laws to protect the Indians are fairly good, he has little chance in the courts if one of the higher classes is the defendant. But if the man works 5 days for you, how is he to take care of his own crops and to watch his cattle and sheep, I ask? That is done by his wife and children, was the reply. The children learn to herd sheep and cattle almost as soon as they are able to walk, and the women hoe the crops. The men help on Saturday and Sunday. All the Indian women work, wives being selected as much for strength as for beauty. They do their own weaving and make all the clothes for the family. On my farm, the men do not start working much before 8 o'clock. They take things easy, and at 10 knock off for a half hour's rest, during which they chew coca. They then go back to work until 1 o'clock, when they take an hour to eat the lunch that they bring with them. At 4 o'clock, they have another rest of a half hour for coca chewing, and shortly after that, they stop for the day and go home. By the time it is dark, they are asleep. In further conversation, this man told me something of the Indian villages and how they are governed. He says the estate owner controls the Indians almost entirely through the village officials, who are selected anew each year. Each town has a native alcalde, or mayor, who as a sign of authority carries a cane as big around as a baseball bat, decorated with silver ornaments. Subordinate to him are two other officers with smaller canes. It is the business of these men to punish offenses, pass upon disputes, and administer justice. In addition, each village has a mandon, through whom the proprietor gives his orders and who is a kind of overseer. This office is greatly coveted by the Indians. I asked some questions as to education among these people, and was told that sometimes the children attend the public schools in the towns, but that practically none go to school in the remote districts. It is difficult to establish a school on an estate far away from the railroad. It has to be done through the Minister of Public Instruction, who has a representative in every province. This requires money, time, trouble, and influence, and the majority of the landholders are not interested. Most of them prefer ignorant and submissive laborers to intelligent and independent ones, saying that it is the educated Indian who causes most of the trouble. One of the Basindandos told me that he found the men who had been in the army the most difficult to control, and that he wanted his Indians as workers and not as students. There are many provinces, however, where the Indians work only 2 or 3 days a week for the use of their houses and lands, and in some they are also paid a small wage for their labor. In other places they have small farms of their own and raise stock and crops. Where they have come in contact with better conditions, they have often cast off entirely the yoke of centuries of oppression. A few of them are rich and own mines and estates. In Lima, I met a wealthy Indian who has 3 daughters graduating this year at one of the mission schools. The girls have Indian features, but are by no means unattractive. Their father pays $5,000 gold a year for the rent of his home in the Peruvian capital, and he owns several automobiles. In the cities, wages have been raised, and the lot of the native laborer has been bettered by legislation, the women and children especially benefiting by laws fixing the number of working hours a day. But in the interior, far from railways and outside influences, the lot of the Quechua Indian is little better than it was 100 years ago. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. On Lake Titicaca. Take a seat in the airplane of your imagination and point its nose toward the sky. Guide yourself straight upward until you are almost 3 miles above the level of the sea. Then fly about 4,000 miles to the south, crossing the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea, and passing high above the peaks of the Andes of Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. Descend only a few hundred feet, and you are on the shores of Lake Titicaca, which lies between Peru and Bolivia. It is the highest steam-navigated body of water on Earth. You are as far up in the air as the top of Fujiyama, Japan, and about twice as high as Mount Mitchell. You are on the shores of an inland sea about half as large as Lake Erie, and not far from a snow-clad wall of extinct volcanoes. Much of the high plateau that borders the lake is 13,000 feet above sea level, and the elevation of the lake itself is more than 12,000 feet. As I stand here on its shores at Guaqui, Bolivia, I seem to be on the very roof of the world. Guaqui is at the southern end of Lake Titicaca, not far from where the Desaguadero River flows from Titicaca into Lake Pampa Olagas, or, as it is usually known, Lake Pupo, about 100 miles to the southeast. These two lakes drain a large part of the Andean plateau. The region has a plentiful rainfall, but most of the water comes from the melting snow and glacial ice of the mountains. Lake Pupo is probably drained by subterranean channels, for although it receives more than 200,000 cubic feet of water a minute, it has been proved that only 2,000 feet flow out of it in that time. One can get little idea of these lofty bodies of water from the encyclopedias and geographies. They are shown on the maps as oval in shape, and the usual descriptions say that Lake Titicaca is from 30 to 60 miles wide and 130 miles long. Some authorities state that it covers 3,600 square miles, while others put the area at more than 5,000 square miles. The truth is that the lake has never been carefully surveyed. Its bays and arms are as many as the tentacles of an octopus. The two peninsulas of Huata and Copacabana stretch out from opposite shores and almost meet, dividing the lake into the two sections called by the Indians Titicaca and Winamarca. On the peninsula of Copacabana is located the shrine of Our Lady of Copacabana. Visitors from all over Peru and Bolivia come here throughout the year, although August the 2nd and February 2nd are considered the most important saints' days. On those dates, the pilgrims arrive in a steady procession and include not only the Indians, but a few wealthy whites as well. Titicaca is so deep that in many parts of it, bottom has never been reached. In crossing to Guaqui, I went over places 900 feet deep, and I was told that near the Island of the Sun, a depth of 2,000 feet had been found. When stopping at the island, the boats have to tie up to the rocks on shore, for at that point the lake is too deep to use anchors. I came to Lake Titicaca from Cuzco, riding for 200 miles over the plain, with mountains towering a mile or more above me. The plateau is so far above the sea that 22 Washington monuments, resting one on top of the other, would not equal its altitude. The latter part of the trip was over a flat region that once formed a portion of the lake bed, and I crossed many streams that were winding their way down to this inland sea. As I neared Lake Titicaca, the soil became richer, the cultivated patches increased, and the flocks I saw were larger. Puno, the Peruvian port of the lake, is a town of adobe buildings roofed with galvanized iron and red tile. An American windmill close to the station seemed to wave its arms in welcome to me as I arrived. The train carried me out on the pier to the steamer, on which I embarked for my trip across the lake from Peru to Bolivia. The boats leave Puno twice a week at about 7 o'clock in the evening. One steamer calls at points along the shore of the lake, and the other makes a direct run, arriving at Guaqui at 9 or 10 o'clock the next morning. The four steamers in service are vessels of from 950 to 1,600 tons. They have fairly good accommodations for passengers, and my little stateroom was well ventilated and comfortable. The captain and the purser were Peruvians, and the sailors Indians. These lake boats were made in Europe and sent here knocked down, the parts being brought over the railroad from Molendo to Puno, where they were assembled. The first boat was put into service on Lake Titicaca before the days of the railroad, and was carried up the mountains in pieces on the backs of men and mules. As we steamed away from the pier and out into the lake, I stayed on deck to watch the shifting landscape. The skies above Titicaca were extraordinarily beautiful. The clouds rose up from the shores like walls fitting into a vault of heavenly blue, and our ship seemed to be shut off from the rest of the world. The fleecy white masses were blown this way and that by the winds, and the scenes changed every moment. It rained just before sunset, and afterward a mighty rainbow spanned the lake. As I looked, I thought of the vast treasure vaults of the Andes, and the gold that may really have been at the two ends of that rainbow. A little later, the blazing god of the Incas dropped below the horizon, painting the sky with 100 tints. The gorgeous colors were reflected in the waters of the lake, and we sailed through a haze of gold, copper, and blue. When I arose the next morning, the air was so clear that I could see for miles. The islands seemed to float upon the water, looking like blue balloons rising from a sheet of silver rather than the half-submerged summits of the highest mountain chain on our hemisphere. One island rose out of the lake like a gigantic mushroom of blue velvet, and another looked like a huge whale with its head and tail high above the water. The sides of most of the islands in Lake Titicaca are covered with Indian huts and patches of potatoes, quinoa, and barley. In places, the hills are terraced to form great steps above the curving shores. On many of the islands are ruins of the old Inca civilization. I saw the Island of the Sun, or as it is now called, Titicaca, where, according to the legend, Manco Cacapec and his sister wife were set down upon earth. The rock where these two Incas landed as they dropped from the sky was more sacred to the Incas than Plymouth Rock is to us, and is still pointed out by the Indians. It is said to have been plated with gold and kept covered with a veil, and the temples about it were decorated with gold. Some authorities say that the name Titicaca comes from the Aymara word Inticarca, meaning cliff or rock of the sun. On this island, about 200 feet above the level of the lake, is a large spring known as the Bath of the Incas. Leading from it to the shore is a rough stone stairway, along which the water runs in a cascading stream bordered by flowers and a few overhanging trees. The Indians still look with reverence upon the Island of the Sun. They once thought that a crop grown upon it was blessed by their deity, and the grain raised there was considered so precious that it sanctified and preserved all others. Therefore, it was carried about over the country, and small portions of it were put in the public storehouses. It was said that a man whose granary contained even one kernel of the sacred Titicaca Island grain would never lack for food. The island is now the farm of a wealthy Bolivian. About 6 miles from the Island of the Sun is Coti, or Island of the Moon, which was supposed to have been the wife of the sun. The Incas built there a great convent for the Vestal Virgins. According to tradition, none could be admitted to it except maidens of royal descent, who from their earliest youth had been trained for that service. As the girls reached maturity, they were obliged to take an oath of perpetual seclusion. Some of the records say that not even the emperor was admitted to see them, but others allege that they were his secondary wives, in other words, his concubines. The ruins of the convent show the traces of many rooms surrounding a court. The building was erected high above a series of terraces, the stones and the walls of which were put together without cement. They are as perfectly joined as those in the fortifications of Sacsahuaman or in the temples of Cuzco. In going back and forth between these islands and the mainland, the Indians use boats that are exactly the same as those they had when the Spaniards conquered the country. These boats, called balsas, are made of tall reeds that grow in the lake near the shore. The Indians cut off the reeds with a knife on the end of a long pole and bind them into rolls or bundles 15 or 20 feet long. These are then sewed or tied together with strings of long grass and form the sides and bottoms of the boats. The balsas are shaped like a canoe. They are beautifully curved, and their sides are made so that they extend out at the top to keep the water from splashing in. Many of them are so large that donkeys, llamas, and mules are ferried in them along the shore and even across the lake from one side to the other. The boats are driven by sails, also made of reeds, or are pushed through the shallows by poles from 10 to 20 feet long. When in deep water and there is no wind stirring, the Indians use the poles as paddles. The balsas are practically unsinkable, which is fortunate for their Indian passengers. Because of the extreme coldness of the waters of the lake, these natives almost never learn to swim. The balsa reeds have a cellular pith, like the stem of the banana. They are light when dry, but after they have been in use about 6 months, they become water-soaked. The boats are then no longer safe and are torn to pieces. The reeds are dried and put into further service as roofing on the Indian huts. They are also used for making ropes and baskets and are almost as important to the Titicacans as the bamboo is to the Chinese. Many of the Indians spend almost all their time in their balsas, carrying freight from place to place or fishing in the waters of the lake. Titicaca has two varieties of fish that are especially good to eat. One swims in great schools and is caught by the Indians in nets. These fish are cured in ovens built of little boulders gathered from the shores of the lake. The stones are heated until red hot and then piled up in alternate layers with the fish. After the fish are thoroughly baked and dried, they are sent to La Paz and other markets, being eaten chiefly by the poorer classes. Fresh fish also are often seen in the markets. Titicaca has no fish game enough to attract sportsmen. Several years ago, a movement was started to stock the lake with trout, whitefish, and salmon from the United States, but it was finally decided that those varieties would not thrive here. It seems strange to think of fishing and hunting in these bleak regions of the high Andes. Nevertheless, I am told that millions of ducks nest near Titicaca and Pupo, and I know I saw thousands from the deck of my steamer. These were teal, snipe, mud hens, and several other varieties of wild fowl, all so near that I could have shot them with my revolver. One of the chief shooting grounds of the country is at the mouth of the Desaguadero River, and I am told that hunting parties of Americans from La Paz often bring down hundreds of ducks in one trip. Lake Titicaca is the halfway station on one of the high roads of traffic from the Pacific to the capital of Bolivia. On the wharves of Guaqui are piles of Oregon pine lumber, and our lake steamer carried also American-made flour, mining machinery, and rolls of paper for the dailies of La Paz, together with the boiler of a railroad locomotive. The purser of the boat tells me that there is always plenty of cargo for the steamers, and that during his last trip, he took 120,000 pounds of tin from Guaquil to Puno. Since the opening of the railway from La Paz to the port of Arica on the Pacific coast, more than half the freight into Bolivia has been carried over that line. End of chapter 21. Chapter 22 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Tibet of South America. I have come to a city that is the highest national capital in the world and the commercial center of a region that can be compared only to Tibet in Asia. I am almost 2.5 miles above the sea, and from my hotel window I can see the perpetual snows of Mount Illimani, which towers about 9,000 feet higher. Although one of the loftiest mountains of this hemisphere, Illimani is not really a peak, but rather a vast mountain mass that is impressive because of its enormous height and bulk. It has 4 separate peaks, all of which are eternally capped with white, giving this Andean giant its name, which means snow mountain. Among these peaks, at an altitude of almost 16,000 feet, is a little lake, and on their slopes, glaciers are always slowly creeping downward. When I first visited La Paz in 1898, I crossed the plains between here and Lake Titicaca on a stage drawn by 8 mules. The teams were changed every 3 hours, and we made most of the 45-mile ride at a gallop. On this trip, I came to the Bolivian capital by rail, boarding the train at Guaquil. That port is a town of mud and galvanized iron buildings. It is scattered over a large area and looks somewhat like the desert towns I have seen in Arizona and Nevada. I ate my dinner in the Grand Hotel Guaquil, the meal beginning with the chupa, a greasy soup with vegetables and a great chunk of meat floating in it. There was also fish from Lake Titicaca, beefsteak, and a concoction of potatoes that contained so much pepper that my mouth still burns when I think of it. Leaving Guaquil, I rode in a comfortable train across a region that is bare and bleak in the extreme, although it is almost in the shadow of the great Sorata Range, the grandeur of which is beyond description. The trip takes 3 hours, but at the end of that time, I could still see no sign of a city. Suddenly, the train stopped at the very brink of a great precipice, and there was La Paz, spread out far below me. The city lies in a mighty hollow in the plateau away up here on the roof of the world. Its site is shaped like a giant letter U, 3 miles wide and about 10 miles long. This natural bowl is supposed to have been a depression in the bed of the great inland sea that once covered the plateau. Then, scientists say, the earth rose and the water ran out at the crack through which the Chuquiyapu or La Paz River now flows, leaving the great basin shut in by its giant ramparts. Cultivated patches now extend far up the sides of the basin, and at the bottom are the 2- and 3-story houses roofed with red tiles and galvanized iron, the great churches and public buildings, the wide plazas and narrow streets that make up the city of La Paz. I have climbed the walls of Jerusalem and have tramped for miles about the Great Wall of China. They were made by man, and neither is more than 50 feet in height. The walls of La Paz were made by God and are 30 times higher. They extend upward from the city for a distance 3 times the height of the Washington Monument, ending in a plateau that is more than 13,000 feet above the level of the Pacific Ocean. From the little station on the edge of the basin, I rode down the sides of the walls on an electric trolley, zigzagging this way and that in great winding curves. Here the cars flew around a loop, and there they cut a figure eight, while farther on I could see a half dozen different levels of track above and below me. As I descended, the city seemed to grow larger, and the houses, which had looked like toys when viewed from above, became of normal size. I could soon distinguish the streets and the buildings about the great central plaza. At the same time, I began to notice the people, most of them dressed in the bright hues that transform the thoroughfares of La Paz into a maze of waving ribbons and make the city one of the most colorful in South America. La Paz was founded by the Spaniards in 1545 on the site of a former Indian village, where the natives had been washing gold from the river for many years. It is now the capital of a country that, since even before its national existence, had been again and again in the throes of warfare with outside powers and the scene of internal revolutions. It is only within recent years that the Republic has had freedom from disturbances long enough for it to develop its great resources by modern means and to establish railway connection with the outside world. Bolivia was originally a part of the Viceroyalty of Peru, and later was under the rule of the government at Buenos Aires. It owes its national independence in a large measure to the George Washington of South America, Simón Bolívar, for whom it was named when it declared itself a republic. Bolívar was a Venezuelan who, during a visit to the United States in 1809, was greatly impressed with our then new government and returned to South America determined to free his country from Spanish rule. After 10 years of alternate victory and defeat on his part, his efforts were finally successful, and in 1819 he was made the first president of the new Republic of Colombia, which contained the former royal colonies of Venezuela and New Granada. In 1822, Bolivar was called to help the Peruvians in their fight for independence, and 2 years afterward was named dictator of Peru. Later, the present Republic of Bolivia was formed. For a long time, Bolivar had absolute control over Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia, and there has never been any proof that he ever used any of the government resources for his private gain, or that he was ever insincere in his work for liberty in South America. However, dissatisfaction with his exercise of power arose, and he was finally forced to resign, dying shortly thereafter. Bolivia today is probably the third largest of the South American republics. As its boundaries have never been exactly determined, estimates of its area range from 500,000 to more than 700,000 square miles. It is one-fourth as large as the main body of the United States and 6 times the size of Great Britain and Ireland. The republic extends from north to south as far as from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, and it is almost as wide as the distance from New York to Detroit. Nevertheless, practically the only part of the country known to the outside world is the plateau, which is important chiefly for its minerals. It is a mighty treasure vault containing vast deposits of tin, silver, copper, tungsten, and bismuth. As the rugged chain of the Andes comes down into Bolivia from Peru, it divides into 2 great branches, between which lies this high tableland. Only 90 miles inland from the Pacific, it has an average elevation of more than 13,000 feet above the level of that ocean. From north to south, it is about 400 miles long, and from east to west, 100 miles wide. The Bolivian plateau is so large that 8 states the size of Massachusetts could be laid down upon it without touching the slopes of the mighty peaks that skirt its edges. There are large areas of flat country broken at intervals by smaller ranges. Higher than the Peruvian plateau, this tableland is also colder and has practically no trees upon it, although much of it is covered with scrubby bushes and grass upon which alpacas and llamas feed. The winds that sweep over it are extremely biting. Indeed, to protect my face from the intense cold, I often have to wear a sort of knitted helmet of alpaca wool, covering my whole head except my eyes and mouth. Bordering the plateau on the east are the mountains of the Cordillera Real, which contain some of the highest peaks in the New World. It is walled in on the west by the Cordillera Occidental, where Sahama, the monarch of that range, and the snow-clad peaks of Pomerape, Parinacota, and Hualatiri all tower more than 20,000 feet into the sky. In fact, Bolivia has more high mountains than any other country outside Asia. Within its borders are more than a dozen that approximate 4 miles in height, to say nothing of this great tableland, twice as far up in the air as the plateaus of the Rockies. At the edge of the plateau, the land slopes steeply downward, and many mountains that are capped by eternal snows have at their feet all the fruits of the tropics. Traveling on horse or muleback, one can descend between daybreak and sunset from a glacial mountain pass 15,000 feet high to a land of flourishing orange groves. Indeed, dropping down a mile in this part of the world brings climatic changes equivalent to those of a journey 2,000 miles to the north of the equator or 2,000 miles to the south. On the eastern slopes of the Cordillera Real, not far from La Paz, is a district of fertile valleys known as the Yungas. That region has a semi-tropical climate and a heavy rainfall, and is covered with luxuriant vegetation, including plantations of coca, coffee, corn, sisal, and sugarcane. Most of the cane is used for the manufacture of alcohol. There are groves of English walnuts, as well as of oranges, bananas, peaches, apples, and pears. Practically all the fruit of the La Paz markets comes from the Yungas, being brought in on the backs of Indians or on mules. On some days, as many as 5,000 mules and burros go over the trail to the capital. A railway is now being built from La Paz over one of the highest mountain passes of the world and thence down into the Yungas. It is one of a network of lines that are planned to connect the plateau with the lowlands and the surrounding republics. Until recent years, Bolivia has been almost a hermit country. Lying in the middle of the South American continent, it is separated from the Pacific Ocean by the mountains and the coastal desert, and from the Atlantic by the almost unexplored regions east of the plateau. It has no seaport, and until within the last generation, it had no railway connections with the rest of the continent. Even today, most of its fertile lands on the eastern slope of the Andes are practically unknown. Considering the extent of its productive area, Bolivia is one of the most thinly settled countries on Earth. It has an average of only 3 or 4 people to the square mile. Its entire population is less than that of the city of Chicago, and there are not as many whites living here as in Columbus, Ohio. Most of the Bolivians are on the plateau. In fact, 80% of them live 2 miles above sea level, and as many as 60% have their homes at an elevation of 12,000 feet or higher. The majority of the people are Indians who work for the whites and the mixed breeds. Bolivia has no large cities. La Paz has perhaps 100,000 inhabitants, and Cochabamba, the next largest town, has only about 1/3 as many, notwithstanding the fact that it is located in one of the most fertile valleys of all South America. It is the chief distributing point for all of eastern Bolivia and has grown steadily in importance since it has been reached by a railway. Sucre has less than 30,000 people, and the mining centers of Potosi and Oruro still less. Although it is a country almost without cities, Bolivia has 2 capitals. The legal capital is Sucre, about 300 miles southeast of here, which is the seat of the Supreme Court and of the Archbishopric. It was at Sucre that Bolivian independence from Maine was proclaimed in 1825. The city, which had been founded in 1536 as La Plata, was then renamed in honor of General Sucre, the first president of the republic. Sucre is the Boston of Bolivia. It has more of an atmosphere of culture and education and less of commercialism than the other towns of the country. Its lower altitude gives it a pleasant climate and makes it a favorite residence of wealthy retired plantation and mine owners. Even in colonial days, many of the rich men of Potosi had their residences here, and many features of the old Spanish architecture are yet to be seen in its homes and public buildings. The city still contains the former legislative and government palaces and has a university and many churches. The Metropolitan Cathedral is probably the wealthiest in Bolivia, its Virgin of Guadalupe being an image of solid gold adorned with precious jewels and said to be worth more than $1 million. Later, the actual seat of government was changed to La Paz, which is the chief commercial city of the country and more accessible to the rest of South America. It is here that the president, the national officials, and the foreign diplomats live, where Congress meets and where the real work of the administration is done. The president is the big man of Bolivia and is at the head of a government that in form is somewhat like that of the United States. Besides the chief executive and his cabinet, there are judicial and legislative branches, the latter composed of a Senate and a Chamber of Deputies nominally elected by the people. There are a number of provinces and departments administered by prefects and sub-prefects appointed by the federal government. The capital of each department has its municipal council, and the subdivisions have municipal boards. The territories in the northern part of the Republic and in the Gran Chaco on the border of Paraguay are governed by delegates. End of chapter 22.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.